Well, we're doing Plan B today. Welcome. We're going to take a look at the life of Sir Isaac Newton. And first, we'll examine a little bit about his biography. Then we'll take a look at his formal education, his informal education, what today's teachers can learn from Newton and his education, and then how we can use the Isaac Newton Project website and with our students. In the year that Galileo died, Sir Isaac Newton was born on Christmas Day in 1642 in Woolsthorpe by Custleworth. Now, I'm going to be referring to William Stukeley a number of times in the presentation. So before I tell you what's on the slide, let me explain to you first who William Stukeley is. He was a contemporary of Sir Isaac Newton's. He was a bit younger than Newton. He had many conversations with Newton. And then after Newton died, Stukeley went to all of the people that knew Newton and asked them what they remembered of being with Isaac Newton, what he was like as a schoolboy, what he was like as an adult, and so forth. And he ultimately collected these memoirs and published them. They were ultimately published in a book. When he was doing this, he went back to Woolsthorpe and drew the birthplace of Isaac Newton, which was a manor house. Now, you might ask, where is Woolsthorpe? Well, first we'll locate London, and then we'll locate Woolsthorpe. Newton was baptized 1 week later on New Year's Day, 1643, in the parish church. And his baptismal record can be found quite close to this baptistry font in Custleworth. Now, Isaac Newton was born prematurely, and it was said that he was so small that he could fit into a pint mug. And because he was born prematurely, they thought he was going to die immediately. So they kept his little body warm next to this particular fireplace in the manor house. I've made a point of showing you the manor house a number of times because as a scientist and as a historian, I'm most interested in getting things right. And there are Christian books out there which picture Newton's birthplace as a thatched cottage. It was not. It was a manor house. In the early years, we know that his parents and his grandparents were totally uneducated. However, in God's providence, he had an uncle, Reverend William Ashcroft. This was his mother's brother, and this man was educated at Trinity College, Cambridge. Now, Trinity College, Cambridge, at this point in history, was the foremost college in the world for learning. So here is a man who is a close relative of Sir Isaac Newton, in fact, his uncle. And it's very important that we know about this man because the one thing I forgot to tell you was that 3 months before Newton was born, his father died. So he never knew his own father. So this male figure in his life was of great importance to him throughout his life. This man was a cleric, a clergyman in a parish church about 2 miles away, and he took a great interest in little Isaac. We know that at the age of 3, Isaac's mother remarried to a much older man, a vicar, who didn't like children. Except if they were his own, they were okay. So he sent little Isaac home to live with a grandmother. Now, in the early years, we know that Newton attended 2 small village schools, Killingworth and Stoke, and we know at least by the age of 9, he was making sundials. He also was given to graffiti, and so we can see the graffiti in Isaac Newton's on Isaac Newton's wall of his house, the manor house here in Woolsthorpe. Now, he left Woolsthorpe for Grantham to attend the King's School. And the King's School was established in 1329. It's one of England's oldest grammar schools. And while he attended the King's School, it was about 7 or 8 miles away, he lodged with William Clark, who was an apothecary. William Clark married a second time, and his wife had been married before. We don't know exactly, at least I've not been able to nail this down yet because I have several sources that tell me different things. Either William Clark's wife was a dear friend or a relative of Isaac's mother, Hannah, and she had 3 children by a prior marriage. So Newton grew up with these 3 siblings while he was in Grantham. Every day he had to walk to school, and the walk was about a half mile long, and he walked past the Angel and Royal Hotel, which was built in 1203 AD. That's what it looks like today. And each day he passed these buildings in the town of Grantham. He also would have had to walk past St. Wolfram's Parish Church, which has been the site of worship since the 7th century. Now, at the age of 12, Newton entered King's School and attended from 1654 to 1660. And this is what the school looks like today. It still exists, and it's quite a large complex, but the original building where Sir Isaac Newton studied is this building here. And if you go into that building, which is used as the school library today, it is now, as I said, used as the library today. If you walk down the center aisle, at the very back, there's a set of stairway. And if you climb the stairs, right there on that windowsill, you will see Isaac Newton's graffiti. Now, one day on the way to school, he was kicked in the stomach by a bully. And Newton didn't deal with it immediately. He went to school like a good little boy, and 12 years old, 13 years old, and he thought about it the whole day. And at the urging of some of his classmates, and perhaps the son of one of the teachers, Newton decided to challenge the bully at the end of the day. Now, the bully was bigger, the bully was stronger, but Isaac was victorious. So victorious that he pulled him by his ears across the street to the parish church and rubbed his face in the wall of the church. Isaac was remembered by those who knew him as a boy with strange inventions and an extraordinary inclination for mechanical works. Now, this is what Grantham looks like today. You can see the Isaac Newton Shopping Center, and also the town square with a huge statue honoring Sir Isaac Newton. By the way, that's also the town where Margaret Thatcher was born. In 1661, Newton went to Cambridge. He was 19 when he entered Trinity College. And then he finished his studies at Cambridge, and he returned to Woolsthorpe for the summer. And while he was at home, the plague broke out. And the universities of the day, Oxford and Cambridge, were closed because there was concern that all the scholars would die. So he stayed at home instead of for the summer. He stayed for 2 full years. Another act of God's providence. Because those 2 years are known as the remarkable years. Everything that you and I know and remember about Sir Isaac Newton took place in these 2 years. And we think about all that he's done in his life to do it all in these 2 years, but we know from research that those are the most creative 2 years of an individual's life. One day in the late summer, early autumn, a warm evening, he was sitting in the garden under the apple tree. It was laden with apples. And he was watching the apples fall randomly to the ground. And he thought, why do they fall to the ground? Why don't they go to the right or the left or up? Why always straight to the ground? And he began to think about that, and he thought, well, the apples are attracted to the earth, gravity, but the earth is attracted to the apples. You see, he was struggling with this, and he was also trying to figure out how the earth could go around the sun, and how the moon could go around the earth, and how the planets went around the sun. And as he puzzled all this, he began to think in terms of a universal gravitation. 20 years later, Sir Edmund Halley came to Newton 20 years after this 2-year period, and he said, you know, what would be the path of a celestial object, comet, let's say, you know, Halley's comet, what would be the path of a celestial object if it followed certain parameters? And Newton just quickly said, well, an ellipse, of course. And Halley said, well, how do you know? And Newton said, well, I did those calculations 20 years ago. And Halley said, you've got to publish. And Newton said, well, I did it 20 years ago. I've done that. I don't need to do it again. And I've lost my notes. I don't know where they are. Halley said, you've got to recreate your notes, and you've got to publish. And Newton kind of was, you know, going on to other things. He didn't want to do it. Halley kept after Newton, and after a considerable period of time, with a promise that Halley would pay for it, which he did, we have Newton's greatest work, the Principia. And you can get it in paperback today. Here is the first printing of the Principia, which is housed in Cambridge. And they went through a printing, and they sent it to Isaac Newton. They said, look, make some corrections in the margin. Show us how we need to improve it. You know, you proofs. So Newton made the corrections in the margin, and then he signed his corrections. And the Principia was published in 1687. It's because of Sir Isaac Newton that we have a space program today. You see, back 20 years before, on the farm at Woolsthorpe, Newton started thinking about gravity, and he developed three laws of motion. The first, inertia. An object will remain in motion or at rest unless acted upon by an outside force. The second, force equals mass times acceleration. In other words, think about a brick wall. You've got a ping pong ball and you've got a 26-ton truck headed for the brick wall. Which one will exert the greater force? Law two. Law three, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. As he thought through those, having three laws, because of course Kepler had three laws, Newton then went a step further. And he developed a theory of universal gravitation. What he was saying was every object in the universe attracts every other object. So this little remote control, which doesn't work today, is attracting me, and I'm attracting the little remote control. However, the Earth is bigger than both of us, so if I drop it, it will fall to the Earth. But if the remote control and I were out in space and we were about this far apart, it would fall toward me because I'm bigger than the remote control. If you had two remote controls about the same size, they would each attract each other. That's why the moon doesn't really go around the Earth. The Earth-Moon system goes around the sun, and the center of gravity is not in the Earth. It's sort of a little bit out. This became so important, this whole understanding of universal gravitation and allowing us to do our space program, that as a matter of fact, when the Apollo 8 craft circled the moon on Christmas Eve, and they read that scripture, remember, in the beginning God? They asked them, they were very tired from that mission, and they said, well, who's flying the craft? And the astronaut said, well, Isaac Newton, of course. So why do we remember Sir Isaac Newton? He explained motion. That had never been explained before. He did that in 2 years. By the way, he had to develop the laws of calculus to do it. He also invented the reflecting telescope. Now, you can make a very precise large mirror, but you cannot make a very precise large lens. Up to that point in time, they had telescopes with lenses, and you could look at celestial objects, or as Galileo did, or you could look at earthbound objects, but they were limited because of the quality of lens they could develop. Isaac Newton designed a telescope that was using mirrors. And as a matter of fact, until we had the Hubble, it was this basic design that was the largest telescope on Earth, the 200-inch at Palomar. Isaac Newton also studied light, delivered lectures at Cambridge, later at Trinity College. He took a prism, passed white light through it, and realized that white light could be separated into colors. And then those colors could be put back together again into white light. Some thought it was heresy because God is light and him is no darkness. You don't separate God. He did something that I think is most intriguing. He invented the color wheel, first to use and invent and use the color wheel. So the artists in our audience should be interested in that one. At the age of 26, Isaac Newton became the Lucasian professor at Trinity College. Now, that's a position that's been held more recently by Stephen Hawking. Later in his life, he became president of the Royal Society. And then in 1977, he was honored with his image being put on the English pound note because in his later life, he was warden of the mint and then master of the mint. And he did something really important for the British monetary system. But let me just explain the pound note first. Here you see a picture of Sir Isaac Newton. Around his head are apple blossoms. On the table behind him is a telescope and a prism. His hand is holding the Principia, open to a particular page with a particular drawing. That drawing is directly from the Principia. Now, why would Isaac Newton be honored by with his picture being put on the pound note? Well, you see, in those days, there was no standardization of coinage. And so, if I was a merchant, you would bring money in, buy something from me. Maybe it would cost 3 coins. That night, I'd melt them down, make 4 coins. Next morning, put the 4 coins in the till. I made money at night. Worked well, except nobody knew what money was worth. Sound like today? We need Newton today. Anyway, so Newton figured a way to pull back all the metal coinage out of the realm and then remint standardized coins and then reissue them. Now think about this. We're talking about England, hundreds of miles. And we're also talking about a time when there's no internet, no real mail delivery, and no fast transportation. You had to go horseback or carriage. So this was quite a feat. They brought in all the coins, issued wooden coins for a period of time, pulled in all the wooden coins and reissued the standardized coins that were minted. But Newton wrote more on alchemy than physics. A colleague of mine in South Africa, Peter Spargo, reproduced some of Newton's alchemy experiments. He took 50 grams of iron, 50 grams of antimony, and 50 grams of copper. He heated them together and made what is called the net. Newton thought this was really special stuff. Looks like black stuff to me. Anyway, he took antimony sulfide and heated it with iron filings, and he pulled out the sulfur, and he had left antimony crystals. And if you look closely in the sample, by the way, I have these samples at home. Peter gave them to me, and I passed them around my class for many years. And the kids always wanted to break the antimony crystals, so you can barely see them there, but they are there. But Newton wrote more on theology than any other subject. Einstein stated that Newton's theological manuscripts provide a unique insight into a spiritual workshop. 4 publications of Newton's theological writings were issued after his death. The first, 2 notable corruptions of Scripture, A Chronology of Ancient Kingdoms Amended, Observations upon the Prophecies of Daniel and the Apocalypse, and The Temple of Solomon in Latin. The previous 3 are all in English. 2 notable corruptions of Scripture. Isaac Newton was doing lower biblical textual criticism about 100 years before most people were even considering it. He was trying to figure out what the original manuscripts of Scripture were. He took the 1 Timothy 3:16 passage, and he felt the word God should be replaced by the word he, because that was in an older manuscript. On 1 John 5:7 and 8, he felt that verse 7 was not in the original text of Scripture and wrote about it considerably. The Chronology of Ancient Kingdoms Amended is basically a history of the world correlated with biblical history. And by the way, I was in a bookstore in January, and the book in the upper right-hand corner is the one I purchased. It was worth $9, so if you want a copy of that, you can buy it for about $9, I guess. And then he also wrote a commentary on Daniel in the book of Revelation, which is in paperback. Now, I started my studies on Newton in 1978, and as I began my studies, I was betwixt and between, because every book I picked up on Isaac Newton said, Newton believes what I believe, now let me tell you what I believe. And I kept thinking, where is the Fox News? We report, you decide. I wanted to know what Newton believed. I wanted to read his own writings. I wanted to read his own words. I wanted to figure it out. Was he a heretic? Was he unorthodox? Was he a believer? If I picked up a book by a Christian, they said, oh, he was a devout Christian. If I picked up a book by a non-believer, he was a devout heretic or whatever. And I wanted to know what Newton believed, and I couldn't find anywhere that it was, all the books I had none of his quotations. Then I wondered, as I did a little further study, why on earth were his manuscripts hidden for 200 years? Hidden. Does Newton's Bible still exist? Where is Newton's Bible? And so, as Nancy Drew would do, I set out on a quest. I went to Oxford, England. And I said, Do you have Newton's Bible? No. Do you have any of Newton's manuscripts? Yes, New College manuscripts, so I studied those. And I went on to Cambridge. I said, do you have Newton's Bible? No, this is at the University Library in Cambridge. Do you have Newton's manuscripts? Yes, we have a lot. But I still was trying to find the Bible. And while I was in England at Cambridge one day, I rented a car and drove back to Woolsthorpe because I had heard there was a chapel on the Woolsthorpe estate. And I thought, well, just perchance, maybe there's a Bible up in the rafters somewhere. And so I knocked at the door, you know, rented a car, drove up, knocked at the door, asked the little old lady that lived in there, have you ever found a Bible in the rafters? And she said no, but invited me in for a cup of tea. So that was a nice cup of tea. But I went back to Cambridge, and they said, where else should I go? And they said, Jerusalem. So I went to Jerusalem and found most of the manuscripts there. I said, do you know, were there any more? They said, yes, go to Boston. So I went to Boston, and while I was in Boston, I found the paneling from the room where Sir Isaac Newton died. I found a tree that was a graft from the original apple tree on the Woolsthorpe estate. This is all at Babson College. And I might tell you one other real quick thing about Babson College. It was founded by Babson, and he used Newton's laws to save himself from economic ruin during the Depression in 1929. And on the campus is an enormous globe about 50 feet high. At least it was there when I was there. And around the globe it says, what should it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? So I said, do you have the Bible? No. Do you know where the manuscripts are? California. So I went to Palo Alto. I said, do you have the Bible? No. Do you have any manuscripts? Well, here's what we've got. Do you know where there are any more? Yes, Philadelphia. I'm from Philadelphia. And so during the summer of 1981, I went back to Cambridge looking around, poking around, seeing what I could find, and you'll never guess what I found. I went to the Wren Library that July, and I found the Bible, and I went back at Christmas time with my nephew, who's sitting right there when he was 10 years old, and we were able to photograph the Bible. It was hidden, bound between a prayer book and a book of Psalms written in meter to be sung. And of course, everybody wants to see how Newton marked his Bible. You can see the dog earrings, and you can see the notes in the margin, and there's quite a bit of information there. And so last November, I went back to examine the Bible again in the shadow of the statue of Sir Isaac Newton. Newton died March 27, 1727, at the age of 84. So this little premature baby died at a ripe old age. This is his death mask. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with death masks, but in those days, they didn't have photography. So when someone famous would die, they'd always make a mask, a plaster cast of his face, so they'd remember what he looked like. He was buried in Westminster Abbey. And Alexander Pope, a famous poet, wrote a couplet to honor him and to be his epitaph. Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light. Newton thought it was blasphemy. He wrote his own epitaph to be, here lies that which was mortal of Isaac Newton. Now let's take a look at his formal education in Grantham. He was educated at the King's School, and this is how it looked probably in Newton's day. He sat at benches, and they had places to write on. And only boys went to school, by the way, no girls. And boys sat according to academic success. So if you were a poor student, you sat at this end. If you were a stronger student, you sat at this end. So remember the story of the bully? Isaac Newton went back to class the next day, and he realized the bully was ahead of him on the bench, on the form. Well, you know Isaac Newton. So Isaac Newton then surpassed him in academics. And ever after that, Newton was always at the head of the class. But that spirit of competition was good for him. And this is what the school looks like today. And the school was organized according to the Elizabethan Order of 1571. And you ask, what is the Elizabethan Order of 1571? Well, it was probably one of the first national curriculums. School was to be Monday to Saturday. The school hours were 6 a.m. to 11 a.m. and 1 to 5 p.m. The master should teach virtue, honesty, good learning, and church attendance. Holidays were 12 days for Christmas, 12 for Easter, 12 for Whitsuntide, and of course they had the summer off. you were only allowed to do sports once a week. And bows and arrows were allowed, but no bowling or quoiting. Now, the King School, we know a little bit more about that. We know the prerequisites for even entering the King School were that you had to be able to read and write in English, and you had to have your basic numeration skills down. Latin and grammar and Latin authors were taught. Greek was also taught. The Bible and church liturgy were taught, and boys were expected to speak Latin among themselves and penalized if they didn't. If you were absent for more than 13 days, you were expelled. They had a real problem with boys taking off to go home on the farm to harvest the crops, and so they had to put this rule into being. Now, I couldn't find a list of the textbooks that Isaac Newton used at King's School. However, I did find a list of the textbooks used at a neighboring parish school. And thanks to the teachers at Tollocks, I was able to decipher some of that handwriting. So I'm just going to slowly put these up on the screen as you look at them, and you have this list in your handout today. I think it's on page 2 or 3, maybe. So these are the books that were ordered. Every couple of months, multiple copies were ordered. And this was interesting to me because I studied the history of education, and I didn't realize that students had their own copy of the textbook in those days. And they did. Multiple copies were ordered every couple of months of these books in Hutoff Parish. Also, the school provided paper books, and the King School also provided pencils and candles in wintertime, if they needed them, obviously. Now, let's talk about the faculty at the King School. I've become very intrigued with the faculty because Henry Stokes had a huge impact on the life of Isaac Newton. He was the master, the headmaster. He was the head teacher in charge. He was 34 years of age. He was educated at Pembroke College, Cambridge. He had at least 7 years of teaching experience, and he was widely respected in the community for improving the school, and he was highly esteemed and honored in Grantham. In those days, in order to vote in Grantham or carry on business, you had to be a freeman. And if you were not born in Grantham, you were not a freeman. So how did you become a freeman? You had to pay a sum of money. I believe it was £10, which would have been a huge amount of money in that day. So Henry Stokes went to pay to the town fathers the sum of money. And they respected him so much, they absolutely refused to take his money. And they gave it back. They said, no, we want you to be a freeman in our town, and you don't need to pay us any money. Henry Stokes was a very good scholar and an excellent schoolmaster. He was probably one of the best teachers that the King School has had in those days. He was committed to his students and their learning. He knew the subjects he taught and how to teach those subjects to students. He managed and monitored student learning, and he was a member of the learning community. At one point, Hannah Newton wanted to pull Isaac out of school and make him a farmer. But Newton wasn't meant for the farm. He would go out plowing with the horse and the plow, and the horse would wander back, and hours later, Isaac would come back without the horse or the plow, because it had already... Newton just couldn't be made any farmer. And the men that worked on the farm said, he's worth nothing but for versity, meaning university. That's all he's good for. But anyway, Hannah didn't have the money, obviously, and she really wanted to make him a farmer because she was a poor woman. That's why she had married this rich vicar in the nearby parish. And so Henry Stokes went to Hannah and said, look, this young man needs to be in school, and because you can't afford it, I'm going to pay for it out of my own pocket. And he also went to Hannah's brother, Reverend Ashcroft, and said, go talk to your sister Hannah. This boy needs to be in school. He should be at the university. That's where he'll have great success. Now, William Stukeley, remember I told you to remember that name? He was the contemporary of Isaac Newton who wrote his memoirs. He said, the world is entirely indebted to Mr. Stokes for Sir Isaac Newton. The power of one teacher. You may have an Isaac in your class. Or a Hannah. Or an Isabel. Joseph Clark was the usher. He was the assistant teacher, and so he would teach the younger boys, and then the headmaster would teach the older boys, and he would help out and help them recite lessons. But Joseph Clark was an amazing man. He studied at Christ College, Cambridge. He was well educated. He was exposed to good mathematics at Cambridge. We know who his classmates were at Cambridge, and they were very good mathematicians. And he had an excellent library, which he shared with Newton. And Newton lodged with Joseph's brother, William Clark, who was the apothecary. So Newton was surrounded by an apothecary and an usher and a teacher who cared for him. Now, what's really interesting is right across the street was the Francis Drake Chain Library in the parish church. Remember this parish church that goes back to 600 A.D.? Well, I don't know how many of you know about chain libraries. I'm going to assume some of you do not. In those days, books were very, very expensive. And so in order to have a library, you had to actually chain the books to the shelf. And this was the first library endowed outside of an institution in England, the first free public library. And it's an amazing thing that it was just about 20 feet in the parish church where Isaac Newton went to school. There's a picture of the inside of the library, and we have a catalog of that library, and we can see what was in that library. First of all, it's interesting to note the vicar and the schoolmaster, Mr. Stokes, were to oversee the library. Now, you can imagine if he has a student who's really into books, how he's going to probably sneak him up into the library some days and let him read. So what was he reading? Well, you see, the library was founded this way. Somebody bequeathed some money to the school and said, look, go take a wagon down to Cambridge and buy any books you can find. And so they did, and they bought willy-nilly anything because books were expensive and they couldn't get everything. So they didn't think through, I want one of this and I want one of that and I want to collect topics, you know, books around a certain topic. They had really quite a hodgepodge, and they also had some duplicates. But they did have 228 titles. But that was huge. Now, I want to draw your attention to this book, and I want you to remember, because I'm going to make a mention of it at the end of the presentation and tell you how you can get a copy of it. And that's as of yesterday morning, I found that out. In 1654, a math book was found in the town of Grantham by Dr. Whiteside, who was studying Newton's mathematical papers. And they first thought the handwriting might have been Newton's, but when they examined it more closely, they thought, no, maybe it's Henry Stokes, maybe it's Joseph Clark, maybe it's the head teacher, maybe it's the usher. It has the usual instructions of the day for surveying the land and calculations of arcs and chords of circles, areas and calculations of signs of angles. Now, this is what the book looks like. It has square root, cube root, how to calculate it, and so on. And in the back of the book, you have an herbarium. Now we'll take a look at Newton's informal education. Perhaps this is what was most influential in his development as a scientist. He grew up on a farm, but he always went to the field with a book. He made sundials at least by the age of 9. We know for sure he was at least 9 years old when he did it. He was encouraged and tutored by his uncle, Reverend William Ashcroft. And his uncle had an excellent library, which Newton used. He lodged with William Clark, who was an apothecary, while he attended the King's School. Now, what did an apothecary do in that age? Well, an apothecary, it's really interesting. Apothecaries aren't like the chemists or the pharmacists of today. An apothecary actually went to somebody's home and mixed lotions and potions and healed people. And so not only were they mixing up these herbs and chemicals and things, but people were getting better, and Newton saw this firsthand. Perhaps this is how he first got interested in alchemy and in some of the scientific work he did later. Newton collected herbs and plants while he was in Grantham. He made detailed drawings and colored them. He demonstrated a mastery of drawing and designing. He demonstrated early mastery of mechanical tools. He showed characteristics of a natural philosopher. The judgment wasn't sound as far as everyday living, but was sound as far as being a scientist was concerned. He had invincible constancy, perseverance, strength of mind, and skill in algebraic notation. Now, he came across this book by John Bate, dated 1634, where he got a lot of his early science experiments. Probably he was introduced to it by Joseph Clark, the usher. This book was awesome. Newton loved this book. It had all kinds of neat experiments, some quite dangerous. And Newton was just fascinated by it. And we know he was fascinated because he loved it so much he made his own handwritten copy of it. Remember, there's no Xerox in that year. Now, from John Bates' book, Newton learned practical skills, gleaned ideas for experimentation, and became more intrigued with books. While a student, Newton equipped himself with tools, hammers, saws, hatchets, chisels, and a whole shop of tools. He built models of doll furniture, mobile trolleys, windmills, sundials. He built himself a vehicle, a four-wheeled vehicle, a cart, run by a crank which he turned while he sat on the vehicle. He constructed a clock, lots of them, water and wooden clocks. He experimented with the construction of kites, paper lanterns. He was always going beyond the prototype, and he would take the lantern, light it, put it on the tail of a kite, and at nighttime, when everybody was in the pub, he'd go fly his kite so they'd think they saw a comet. He repeated and perfected his models constantly, and he observed wind and used it for jumping. When he realized that the wind could push it a little bit, he would always challenge his friends, his schoolmates, to a jumping contest. And he jumped so that the wind would push him, and he would win. And he always did. And the boys couldn't figure it out. Competition again. William Clark Joseph, brother Joseph, was the usher during Newton's days at the school, we said. And while Newton was living with William Clark and spending time with Joseph Clark, a windmill was built north of Grantham on the way to Gunnerby. Now, they'd had grinding mills in all around that area, but nobody had ever built a windmill before. Newton became so intrigued with this windmill that he went home and built his own. Built it four more times, trying to make it better each time. Had a great idea, put it on the roof of the house. So all the townspeople, instead of going on the road to Gunnerby to see the windmill, went to Newton's house to see the windmill on the top of the roof. Now, Newton wouldn't be stopped by that. He then thought, well, you know, I want this windmill to keep going. How can I make the windmill go? So he had an idea. He went to a local farmer, asked for some corn. And then he caught himself a mouse. And he made the mouse operate the mill. And now all the townspeople came to Newton's garret room to see the mouse miller. And they all talked about it. I mean, it's just, records are full of the mouse miller in Newton's room. Can you imagine holding the mouse by the tail as it chases the corn on the other side? Newton was always perfecting his sundials. And, of course, I got to point out this one room to you. I just got to do this. While Newton was at Cambridge, at Trinity College, that was his apartment. And today when you go there, the sundial is right within eyeshot of Newton's apartment in the Great Court. Now, what do we know about Grantham? Well, it began as a Saxon village, and it was 7 or 8 miles from Woolsthorpe, and it was on the main road from south to north, and it was a market town since the 11th century. So by the time Newton got there, it had been a market town for 600 years. It was a place of commerce. People were coming and going. It was like the center of the world, if you will. I mean, if you got to Grantham, you were at the big city. And, of course, then he went off to university. So he had that opportunity to be in Grantham during that time. Now, of course, being on the farm, he had to take his farm products to market now and again. But you see, Newton really loved books. So he would pay one of the hired hand to take the good. He would leave the farm with a wagon full of goods, take them to market with a hired hand, and pay the hired man a little extra to take the goods all the way into town, and he'd sit under a tree outside of town and read his books. We have some more handouts if people need them. You can raise your hands. You didn't get a handout. Whoops, I'm not sure what I did here. Let's see. Running two computers to make this work is a little confusing. Now, what can we learn today as educators from Newton and his education? Well, we can learn some things from his formal education. The master and the usher were highly qualified to teach. The master and the usher took a great interest in Newton. The master was the overseer of the chained library, and the usher had a good personal library. And Latin and Greek, were encouraged him to be precise and work vigorously and rigorously. And competition was beneficial for Newton. What can we learn from his informal education? He collected tools. He built models constantly. That's that kinesthetic piece of learning. He observed William Clark, the apothecary. He was curious and observant about the natural world, watching the apples fall to the ground and wondering what caused them to fall. He repeated and perfected his experiments constantly, and he wasn't satisfied with doing it once. He wanted to make it better. And then his uncle took an interest in him. Newton's kinesthetic learning. No science textbooks was used with an answer key at the back. Science was learned with hands-on activities. Experiments were repeated and perfected, and Newton had a rich learning environment, the farm and Grantham. He had access to libraries, and most importantly, he had a caring uncle, schoolmaster, and usher surrounding him. The conclusions? Teachers play key roles in the academic development of students. They must be academically qualified. They must be able to teach. And being academically qualified in organic chemistry and being able to teach chemistry to 11th grade students are not necessarily the same thing. They must be able to give careful attention to each student. You don't know if you've got a little Isaac in your classroom or a little Ethel or whoever that could be a great scientist one day. You have to remember that teachers are members of learning communities, and of course, I think classical schools know this better than public school teachers, which is the background I come from, but you work normally with parents. The public school teachers consider parents to be the enemy, and I think that's wrong, at least some of the ones I worked with. Learning environments should always be rich. Students should be encouraged to observe the natural world around themselves, be curious about everything, make collections, use tools, make models from scratch without, not a little car kit, but, you know, here's a whole bunch of supplies, cardboard and bits of balsa wood and whatever. Make a model of something. That should be going on in the elementary grades. That's what Newton was doing. Students should be encouraged to perfect their models, make working models, experiment, persevere. Science should be taught kinesthetically with hands-on experiments, with open-ended experiments, with no predetermined answer. Now, in 1979, when I started on this, I said there was no Fox News, we report, you decide. So in order, whatever book I looked at, everybody said, well, Newton believes what I believe, now let me tell you what I believe. And there were no manuscripts that I could read. The only way I could read Newton's manuscripts were to go to England, Israel, Massachusetts, and California, and other places. However, we've got the internet. So let me talk to you about the Isaac Newton Project website. This is something that classical school teachers, more than anybody else, I think, can use to great advantage. The best way to get there, the easiest way, is to Google Isaac Newton Project. Isaac Newton Project. Now, when you do that, you will get to this page. This is the home page. It looks rather simple, but is one of the deepest, most complex websites I've ever dealt with. You will see Isaac Newton's documents in two forms, the normalized and the diplomatic. Now, what they are doing is gradually collecting these manuscripts from all over the world and putting them online so that you can read them. They're not all there yet. It's going to take another year or two, maybe three. But right now, a good chunk of them are there, so you can begin to use Isaac Newton's original writings right now with your students if you choose. Now, let me explain to you what the difference between normalized. Let's first look at English manuscripts. Here's an example of the normalized manuscript. You can see it's easy to read. If you look at the diplomatic one, what you see are all the corrections that Newton made. So I can go back and forth and compare, see how he edited his work. Now you can look at Latin manuscripts as well online, Newton's Latin manuscripts. Here's a Latin manuscript, normalized. Here's the diplomatic version with the corrections. Editorial comments. ILLEG is illegible. Now, the other thing you can do from this project, I mean, there are hundreds of documents on here. You really ought to explore it. The other thing you can do from this is you can go to the alchemy writings, and this will link you automatically to the University of Indiana's Chemistry of Isaac Newton page. And here you will find the chemistry documents. Again, normalized and diplomatic. And here's an example of the normalized, and compare it to the diplomatic text. So you can compare how he editorialized it. You can also see some examples of some of Isaac Newton's chemistry experiments. One other thing you can find on here is Newton's copy of the John Bate book that he loved so much that he made a handwritten copy of. Now, if you want to compare Newton's copy and the original, and you only have the internet access, by the way, it is in libraries around the country, and if you do go to, what's the WorldCat, you can find out what library near you has John Bate, but you can also go to Internet Archive, and that will give you the original John Bate. And then you can go to the Newton Project and find a transcription of what is written in this notebook, which is in the Pierpont Morgan Library in New York City. By the way, they don't let you open that book anymore. The only way you can examine it is from microfilm. It hasn't been opened in 40, 50 years because it's so fragile. You can also find one of the original manuscripts of Stukeley, Remember, Google search the Isaac Newton Project. What can educators do with the sites? Well, you can study Newton and his views on various topics. You can compare normalized and diplomatic texts. You can reproduce some of his chemistry experiments, compare Newton's copy of John Bate with John Bate's original work, study Newton's copy of John Bate and compare it with present OSHA standards, reproduce some of John Bate's experiments after safety considerations are made. John Bate's experiments, in some respects, are very dangerous. And so we've looked at a biography of Sir Isaac Newton, Newton's formal education, his informal education, what teachers can learn from Newton and his education, and the website. Let me leave you with Newton in his own words. This is, I think, my favorite quote of Newton. Now, remember, some think he's a heretic, some think he's a believer. I leave it to you to decide. Let me, therefore, beg of thee not to trust to the opinion of any man concerning these things. He's writing about Revelation. For so it is, great odds, but thou shalt be deceived. Much less oughtest thou to rely upon the judgment of the multitude, for so shalt thou certainly be deceived. But search the Scriptures thyself, and that by frequent reading and constant meditation upon what thou readest, and earnest prayer to God to enlighten thine understanding if thou desirest to find truth, which if thou shalt at length attain, thou wilt value above all other treasures in the world by reason of the assurance and vigor it will add to thy faith, and steady satisfaction to thy mind, which he only can know how to estimate, who shall experience it. I've included that in your handout. That's from Yehuda Manuscript 1.1, and the emphasis is mine. Wait a minute. We're not getting volume. Let's go back. I need to thank my niece Katie Martin for these wonderful photographs of my great nieces and nephews and some other children from the school. The Gravity Song, I need to acknowledge with great thanks to Ronald J. Brown of IntelliTunes. He copyrighted this song in 2006 and granted us permission to use it for this conference. I urge you to look at the website www.intellitunes.com. That's intellitunes.com. Now, I have a couple other things I want to tell you about that are really exciting. Tuesday morning, I got a letter, an email from Lincoln Archives. Remember I told you about that 1654 math book that was found in Grantham in the handwriting of perhaps Newton's master or maybe his usher? Well, the gentleman in the lower left corner and the middle, he's also in the middle in the upper right corner picture, is Sam Branson. He wrote the history of the King's School. He's a retired math teacher, and what he's done with that book is phenomenal. He's taken the book and he's prepared a document which in the center column includes a direct photocopy of the handwriting from that book. Again, we're not sure who the author was, but it could well have been Newton's teacher. On the left-hand side, he has an official transcript of what is in the center column. On the right-hand side, he has a mathematician or a mathematics teacher's comments about where this information came from. I was granted permission on Tuesday morning by Lincoln Archives for the first time in the history of the world to make this available to you here at this conference. If you would like a copy, and you don't have to, but if you would like a copy, I'd be glad to get you a copy at cost. Now, there are two ways to do it. One way is to give me a check, which has your name on it, and your address, so I know where to send it, for $20. The other way to do it is to leave $20 in a sealed envelope at registration for Helen Martin and put your name and address where I'm supposed to mail this copy to you. And I will take them home, I'll make the copies, and I'll put them in the mail, and that will just cover them. So if you want this book, it's about 90 pages, and it's very interesting. So if you're teaching science or math, or you know somebody that is, I think you will find this a really interesting thing to have in your collection and to examine. So now, I think our time's just about up. I mean, there's countless stories I could tell you about Newton, but I really love him. He's really a neat man. But he was really weird. I mean, if he was in your class, you probably would have, well, if he was in a public school, he certainly would have been categorized. He was emotionally disturbed, irrational, poor student, couldn't do anything in a class by himself. We thank God that he had a wonderful teacher by the name of Henry Stokes. So what can I, any comments or questions briefly? Yes. Yes, and I did a paper on that a number of years ago. My opinion, Leibniz, we use Leibniz notation for calculus. However, there's good reason to believe that Leibniz got a copy of Newton's work on fluxions. And so Leibniz was stealing Newton's ideas, or else they developed them simultaneously. But at least Newton got them. Well, I don't even say simultaneously. Newton got them before. Leibniz discovered them later. But his is the one whose notation we use today. Does that help? Anything else? Yes. No, because I don't think in the education that he received in his day, it would have spurred him on. I think the things that happened was that it spurred him on was he had an exceptional classical school teacher who cared about him and realized that he had a real propensity for mechanical things and encouraged that propensity. I also think that Newton did some things because he was born that way, and God made him that way. So I think what we do is we look at his how he worked, how he lived, what kinds of things he did. And maybe the students that we have in our classrooms don't naturally do those things, but maybe we can encourage them. Maybe we can encourage them to build models and create things. Newton did it naturally, but maybe we can encourage and produce some opportunities for students to create their own models of things that work. So I think he gained his science more from his informal education and from the encouragement of the teacher and the usher and the apothecary and the uncle around him. Remember, his mother was uneducated. Anything else? So go read Newton for yourself, in Latin or English. Thank you for coming.